Hey, this is This Week in Self-Hosted. I'm your host, Ethan. Today, I'm joined by a guest co-host, Dan Brown, the developer of Bookstat and open source advocate. Dan, thanks so much for joining me this week.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me on.
Yeah, so I had the opportunity to have you on my podcast a couple months ago, which was a great conversation. And I just want to reiterate for those who are new to my content, my channel, I actually rely on you a lot regularly for information about open source issues and license questions. And so it's very appropriate to have you on this week because this week's newsletter actually has a ton of content focused on just the idea of open source and how the community needs to manage and handle it, and maybe some apps who might not be observing or respecting open source licensing and what that means. So I'm very excited at just the coincidental timing to have you on the episode to chat through some of this with me. So I do want to jump into it. We have a lot of content as usual. I do want to kick off really quickly though. Actually, the newsletter hit 10,000 subscribers this week. If you follow me on the Fediverse at all, I chatted a little bit about that. Yeah, thanks. Thanks. It's been exciting. Oddly enough, most of my views actually come from web views. I think people subscribing via RSS, but the email subscriber count is still kind of a cool metric to track things with. So that was exciting. Thanks everyone for the support and thanks to all who are subscribed. Hopping into the news, a couple big things happening here. I'll kick off with the Matrix announcement. Matrix 2.0 was announced this week or was released. Matrix is an open source chat messaging protocol with a couple different server implementations and chat clients. And this week they dropped the new version, which comes with some features that I honestly, Dan, I had to familiarize myself with them a little bit. I'm not a Matrix user, and I've actually never self-hosted my own chat platform before. But apparently Matrix 2.0 comes with sliding sync, which I think is very helpful for the first time people log on, just kind of getting their clients set up and integrated with their profile and servers. Came with native authentication, and I actually had to make a note in my show notes for this. When I saw that, I was like, oh, that's cool. People can implement their own SSO, but it's actually not that. It's just their own implementation of OpenID Connect within Matrix.
Yeah, I'm not sure more. Exactly what this means. I'll be trying to understand this myself if they're acting as a OpenID Connect provider in this case, because they say that they're not acting as a single sign-on in their update notes. So, yeah, it might be the case of the provider, but I haven't fully understood what they're saying in their blog post. But either way, I'm a big fan of OpenID Connect. As someone that maintains a lot of authentication platforms on Bookstack, OpenID Connect is by far my most favorite standard because it's such a good, kind of simple to understand, strong standard.
From a development standpoint, is that actually the easiest to implement?
I mean, it depends what libraries you have available because, you know, you might find libraries that do most of the heavy lifting for you. But in terms of understanding the spec and having standards to work to, OpenID Connect is by far the best from a developer point of view, from my experience, just because it's relatively strong compared to like LDAP or SAML2. Mm-hmm. There's not as much like specific scenario variation is quite strict, which, you know, I enjoy from a developer perspective because it means less edge cases and less scenario testing on specific services.
Yeah, I guess it's nice if you can just leverage protocols other people have already built. You don't have to worry about being an expert in that while you're building your own software and platform. Mm. The last update I saw added to Matrix 2.0 was just native voice over IP and video calls, which I know is really important to people. When I think about replacing things like FaceTime and iMessage and things like that, obviously the video aspect is just as important to some people as the actual text capabilities. So I think it had supported it before, but now it's more native, maybe doesn't need as many integrations or third-party extension support. Next item up on the list was Omnivore, which is kind of a read it later pocket style app, was acquired by 11 Labs. This week, Dan, curious what if you're aware of what implications that has on the licensing for Omnivore and what that would mean for something like that moving forward.
So they're saying they're keeping the source code open source, So it should still be available for people to take and fork. This does mean, I think they're ending the hosted service quite soon, which is the controversial element to this one. I think it's later this year or within the next few months. So if you're using that as a hosted service already, then you want to make sure you get your data backed up and out of there if you can. But yeah, it's under the AGPL v3 license, which kind of generally makes sure that code remains open to those that it's distributed to. But obviously that code is going to need someone to maintain it and to keep the service going. There's probably implications in terms of the trademark. I'm not sure if Omnivore or Elven Labs would allow it to be renamed called Omnivore if someone creates a fork. But you should be able to fork it under a new name, and it should be able to thrive and survive under new ownership if anyone's eager out there. So it looks like the backend is written in TypeScript with Swift and Kotlin used for the apps. So if you're a developer in one of those languages and you've been searching for an open source project to get involved with, this is a good chance to go and do that, because you've got a existing user base that's kind of hungry to be supported for the next, well, potentially years. So, you know, get in there and you've got an audience to capture right away.
Yeah, I guess this is kind of a good example of the beauty of open source software. You know, they're shifting away from this platform to something maybe not as open source or through the acquisition, but the code base is out there for anyone who wants to do something with it. It's just a matter of, is someone going to do something with it? So I guess only time will tell. Mm-hmm. The next section I have in the news portion of the newsletter is I occasionally feature a GitHub repo that is very popular across the community that consists of a bunch of Proxmox helper scripts, I think it calls itself, just really simplified ways for people to spin up things on Proxmox who might not be as familiar with how to make their way around installing complex things. And as usual, I feel like I do need to throw a disclaimer in there. Don't just trust scripts that you find online. When you come to a repo like this, you should probably do some digging and research before you just start blindly executing scripts on your servers. But I do know this one has a very great, good reputation. So I know, Dan, you and I have both used this before. We chatted about this a little bit ahead of time. Yep. But T-Tech, the maintainer, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that username correctly, announced this week that they're going into hospice care, which is awful. I do wish them the best. So there are a couple discussions on their repo. There's one where they announced that they're going into hospice care, and it's been really cool seeing the support of people rallying behind them and coming in and just kind of wishing them the best. But this discussion also popped up just today, a little bit ago, as I was following up on this, as we were prepping for this recording, starting to chat about what does it look like for this repository moving forward. There are only a few comments within here because it's so new. But if you're interested, and if anyone listening to this is interested in helping the community maintain this, I would recommend checking out the link, which is in my newsletter, to this discussion and just voicing your opinion and chatting about maybe how you can help.
Yeah, it's a very Bash heavy project. So if your expertise is Bash, or you want to make Bash your expertise and get really familiar with scripting in Unix systems, then by all means, you know, jump in, get involved, and you know, keep this going, and help out the community.
Yeah, and I looked everywhere to see if there were any support links I could find for T-Tech. I could not find anything anywhere to donate. So again, there's a discussion in here where they announce and people are just you know, voicing their support. So if you've used this and appreciate it, I'd also recommend just going in there and thanking this user for some of the work they've done. And then the last thing I have in the news section, Dan, I wanted to chat with you a little bit about this while still moving things along. There's a really interesting article I found by the Register this week that is called The Open Secret of Open Washing. And I think it was a little more focused on AI, but it talks a little bit about how some companies are starting to leverage kind of the open term in their naming conventions and how they advertise themselves while not really being open. And so it talks a little bit about how deceptive that is and the implications that has on the community. Any like particular thoughts after reading that?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that's been really common. I mean, it started in the quite early in the AI community, especially as you have a company like called OpenAI, that then started putting out non-open models. And by non-open in that sense, you know, it's immediately obvious when they come with terms to prevent certain use cases, like you cannot use this in commercial uses, or you may not use this to generate this kind of content and things like that. And then Meta was a big one as well. They've always been very upfront about calling their models open while having a lot of those terms attached to the licenses of their models. But then the there's current goings on with the OSI that are attempting to define what open source means to a large language model, because there is a lot of kind of questionables around that. You know, does the data itself have to be freely accessible and under a certain license and things like that? And I think there's quite a lot of controversy, you know, where do you draw that line? But the OSI are attempting to draw that line. Whether anyone will continue to listen to the OSI with what they come out with for large language model is to be seen. But yeah, otherwise, this isn't something new at all. This occurs quite a lot in the normal software world outside of AI. And it's because open source as a term has value. It has marketing value. It has the value to attract new users. It's very good for adoption. So people tend to use it, and a lot, and in quite a few cases, they use it in ways that users might not expect or could be misleading. So yeah, you do get a fair bit of open washing within standard self-hosted software, which is something that I try and push back on. If anyone's spent a long time in open source or self-hosted subreddits, they might have seen one of our messages pop up on a post, just advising where a project might not be as open source as they advertise. So yeah, it's an existing thing, and just a case of calling out or educating upon it when it occurs, really.
Yeah, so for anyone who's listening who is not familiar with all of Dan's work, he actually maintains a repository that he calls Open Source Confusion Cases, which I will happily link in the description of this video, where he I want to say calls out, but you're really just, I think you're just trying to hold the community accountable for respecting the open source license. And so it's just a couple examples of companies who might be misrepresenting their licensing terms, you know, maybe for bad purposes and intentions, or maybe just mistakenly. Super interesting. And actually, this particular article in the newsletter, Dan, I remember last year, this tripped me up in my newsletter. I included something about AI. I think it mentioned open in the name. I remember after I posted it, you reached out to me and you're like, yeah, this isn't open source at all. And I was like, oh, I guess I better remove it. So I've fallen prey to this myself.
Yeah, it's quite common, especially if the company uses open in their company name or the product name. It's quite common that, you know, they're doing that because it provides an advantage. But yeah, you have a look at their project, their code, and it's very much not what you might expect from something that calls themselves open.
Yeah, easy to fall prey to something like that. So thank you for the work you do on that front. That being said, I do want to shift to software updates. In the show notes here, I have a couple that stuck out to me, and then Dan, I'll pass it over for you for to anything that might have stuck out to you. First on my list, I have ListMonk. ListMonk is a newsletter platform for people who want the ease of sending out email newsletters without the complexity of just doing it through a normal email client. The reason I'm calling this out is because they introduced multi-user and OpenID Connect support this week, which I know my readers absolutely love and eat up stuff like this. Everyone wants something like single sign-on. And of course, multi-user is also nice for these platforms, so people aren't spinning up multiple instances for multiple users. Some other things that stuck out to me. Last week, I actually talked about a few photo apps that dropped large updates that weren't image. I know we're all drawn to image and what's that done, what that's done for the Google Photos alternative landscape. Two more actually popped up this week that I wanted to call out because, again, the more alternatives, the better. And so Lychee, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, dropped a fairly large release. It is another photo application. And then PhotoField down here also dropped a relatively large update. So if you're looking for a photo and video app and image isn't quite doing it for you, I would recommend checking these two out. Last week, there were two more. If these two don't do it for you as well, encourage you to look around and try and find some of those things. Last thing I have, Obsidian Live Sync. A lot of self-hosters love Obsidian And I understand why. It's a great platform, but it's not necessarily self-hosted. But through this plugin, this LiveSync plugin, you can essentially self-host the sync server or the backend of Obsidian. So it's almost as if you were self-hosting it. So you install the client on your phone or your PC, and then you point it to the sync server, and then that's how it syncs your data. I don't see this one pop up much, and this week it popped up for the first time in a while with a significant update. So a lot of things happening across the board, but if you're an Obsidian user, recommend checking out this week's release.
And then from me, paperless NGX caught my eye, just because I know it's a much loved application within the self-hosted world. And in particular, the feature of the OAuth 2 Gmail and Outlook email support is something that stood out to me, just because that's something that's been requested on Bookstack quite a lot in the past, I guess over a year now, and it's something that I've pushed back on because it's, whereas like your normal email might go over something like SMTP, which is a standard across all email providers, you just implement SMTP and then it works with all everything else that supports SMTP. These OAuth 2 implementations generally need to be built specifically against certain providers. And to me, it's always felt like it's like, because it's specifically Gmail and Outlook, it's felt like kind of Google and Microsoft kind of pushing their will of moving people away from a kind of a good standard onto a having to specifically implement custom providers against their platforms. Which puts a lot of work on basically all the applications that might need to connect to their platforms for email. So it just seems a bit odd to me that, you know, the these companies aren't gathering together to create a more formal standard to fill the weaknesses that they report about SMTP rather than using their own OAuth APIs. So I'd be interested to hear if there's other kind of open source maintainers that have come across this, or if anyone knows of any standards that are kind of going across in the background and being worked on to kind of solve this issue in a more standard way. Because, you know, as a developer myself, I don't want to have to specifically test against every email platform that people might want to connect to. And I'd rather not especially right. go out of my way to do that just for these giants forcing their will on the community.
Yeah, it's interesting. I feel like I don't see this a whole lot. And when I do, I feel like I just see people talking about Cloudflare and the access capabilities that provides, where you can essentially, you know, give people access based on a whole slew of services, however you want to do it. You can bring your own. But I think that's authorization and not authentication, which I think what paperless is doing here is authentication. So
yeah, this is specific for just email sending.
In terms of how the
application connects to the email server.
Got it. Yeah, that's very interesting. I guess email is an important aspect of paperless, so maybe they're just trying to support as much as they can for additional users.
Oh yeah, nothing against them implementing that at all, because it's helpful to users that just want to get on with it. It's just where do you draw the line in terms of supporting specific platforms? It's always a tricky thing.
Yeah, that's fair. And before we shift off, I forgot, I did want to mention this Redeck here. This is, I think, a relatively new bookmarking platform. I just found it funny when I was going through releases this week. They were pretty quick after the Omnivore announcement that we chatted about earlier, where they're being acquired, to release capabilities to easily import bookmarks from Omnivore. So if you're an Omnivore user and you're looking for another platform, check out Redeck. I think it's a great platform even without those capabilities, but again, given the timeliness of what's happening with Omnivore, I thought that was worth mentioning out. Want to shift just a little bit into breaking changes. There were a couple that flew onto my radar this week. GoProxy is a reverse proxy that now requires authentication and also has some new required environment variables. If you use that, please read the release notes before you go ahead and upgrade that. Image frequently on this list. They have a lot going on and their releases are great, but it's very, very important to read images release notes before you upgrade this week. They renamed an environment variable. And then they also replaced some variables for those who are using something like Prometheus for metrics and to track and log those things. So if you're doing that, just make sure you read up on what they're doing as far as shifting away from. I think they consolidated like 5 or 10 different metric variables into just 1 or 2 telemetry variables to make it a little more streamlined. Jellyfin received a large update this week. I know Jellyfin in my recent survey was the most popular platform that people are using to stream their media, and actually just self-hosted in general. It was the most popular platform when I asked what people's favorite platforms were. There were some minor breaking changes. So if you haven't upgraded, please make sure you read the release notes before you do that. And then lastly, Music Assistant is a music streaming platform that's spun off from some of the Home Assistant developers. Really cool project. They had some specific provider changes. I think probably relevant to a smaller portion of my readers, but it's a reality and it happens. So make sure you check that out if you're a Music Assistant user. So want to shift into new software again. I just have one in particular I wanted to chat about, and then Dan, I'll let you call out any that might have stuck out to you this week. The very first one, actually, Image Public Proxy. I liked it a lot. Last couple of weeks, a lot of what I'll call image companion apps have been popping up in the newsletter. The community is really rallying around the platform and creating all sorts of new tools to extend functionality, which I really like. And so something released this week called Image Public Proxy, and essentially what it allows users to do is easily share their photos and videos publicly without exposing their actual image instance. So the idea is, rather than making your image instance publicly available, you keep it private and only accessible via a VPN or, you know, WireGuard or however you would normally maintain that. And then you make this proxy publicly available, and it's a lot more strict and has some firewall capabilities that will very selectively make sure that any photos or videos you decide you want to share publicly, they're the only ones people can access. So essentially you spin this up, you give it its own subdomain, and then within Image, you can plug in that subdomain and say, hey, when I share photos, use this link to share them, and it'll use this public proxy link and just let you easily do that. So I found that really cool.
Cool. And then I wanted to know a couple. So I'm not sure how you say it, Parsed or Parsed.
I was wondering the same thing. Sharing.
I'm always interested when I come across something like that. It's like, how does that work? How is that secure? And it looks like it does it via kind of one-time use links where the password is encrypted within that link. But then the question is always, you know, if you're using a one-time link instead of sharing the password directly, how do you share the link? Because it's got kind of the same access, concerns, because you just need that to then get the password. So right. I would recommend if you're using something like that, just consider the security implications of that. And it's probably better in those kind of scenarios is to use two completely different means. So maybe use that for like half the password, and then, I don't know, call over phone. That's probably not secure, but over a secure line to say the other half, just so you're not transmitting the whole password in one go to someone. And then OpenSpots is the other one that caught my eye, just because I kind of like any app that's heavily map based. And this is kind of cool because it's an availability tracker. So say you got a whole bunch of rooms over a campus, and I think this is built by university to track things within the campus. You can then show that live on a map. So you can see the map with all the little dots on it showing red and green for availability. And I just thought that's a pretty cool idea. This seems to be a fork of an application called Spots, which also does seem open source. I'm not sure how that name come about or what the relation is between the two, but OpenSpots does seem to be a little bit better documented in terms of its API and configuration. But I just thought that's kind of a neat little app. Always enjoy something with a good map visualization.
Yeah, it's really cool. It looks like maybe Spots is just limited to, looks like it's built specifically for one university. So maybe OpenSpots just makes it a little easier to deploy across different locations. But this absolutely falls into that category of self-hosted applications that I want so badly to deploy, but I don't have any use case or reason to
you
deploy.
You find yourself trying to make a use case, and before you know it, you've got all your rooms of your house plotted out on this and showing who's in there and what's the availability of each room.
And making my wife have to book a time slot to enter a room.
Well, have you checked the map for availability?
Oh, I love it. She's going to hate me for this, but this looks great. I just want to shift over to latest directory apps before we jump into the last section on community content. The one thing I had to call out here, a lot of cool applications actually, Etherpad actually at the top of the list, which is also in my content spotlight. It's a real-time collaborative document editor. And so this is important for me because each week I have a different guest co-host on the show. And so I've been looking for ways to collaborate on putting together show notes so we just know how we're going to approach the episode. And so actually for the first time this week, Dan and I are using Etherpad to actually coordinate the show notes. I have it up on the side here. So we've been able to see in real time what each other are adding to the documentation. So we know, hey, Dan's going to talk about this. I'm going to talk about that. But obviously there are a lot more use cases than just something like that. I would look at this almost like a Google Doc replacement. You know, when you're in Google Docs and you can see people typing and if you're working on a group project or something, that's what this is. Everything's color coded so you can see who added or wrote or edited what. So definitely check that out if you're looking for something like that. Not really meant to be a wiki, really more like, hey, here's a one-time pad for this particular project. You use that. You have to install plugins to get lists of like historical pads and stuff. So not sure I would recommend it for necessarily for note-taking where you need to go back and reference things, but good for things like this. Anything stick out to you in this section, Dan?
A couple of the apps caught my attention, specifically Novu and Windmill, just because typically when I come across applications, I like to have a look at their licensing because that's what I'm interested in. And just, yeah, a couple of red flags came up when looking at those, specifically with Novu. I saw a common pattern in there where their open source code relies upon non-open proprietary licensed enterprise code. So technically, when you're using those applications as they're provided, even though the advertiser is open source, you're technically using code that requires a different enterprise agreement that may be agreeing to more terms than you imagine. It's specifically not open source. And it wasn't clear up front in like their README as well that these extra licenses were at play. But I raised that with them yesterday, and they came back this morning, and they seem quite keen to fix those issues and to improve on things. So that's a good sign. So while these issues do exist, they're keen to improve, which is good
for them.
And then on the Windmill side, again, it's advertised as open source, but there's quite a few fixed limits within the open source offering. Things like, I think they're like users, teams, and things like that. They're capped off, which is something that you might not expect in an open offering because it's rather arbitrary. It's just a hard-coded number set in the source code, essentially.
Right.
But upon that, the licensing is also very complex. You'd have to scan through each file for different bits that they flag within the code because they say that's provided under a different license. And that itself has a lot of complications because it's mixed with AGPL, and I'm not really sure you can do that, but that's what they're doing. I'll just be a little bit wary on that front because it's definitely not clear what actually is open source or not within that project. And again, I've raised that as a comment within one of their existing issues, but I've yet to have a response. But it was only yesterday which I raised these concerns.
Yep, that's fair. It's interesting, the section here, the apps I add to my directory of applications are usually a mixture of apps I've discovered, but also user-submitted apps. People reach out to me via email or whatever and say, hey, I have an app to add. And both of these were user-submitted applications. And usually when someone does that, I'll just hop onto the repo, browse, just make sure it can be self-hosted. Again, we talked about this a little bit beforehand. I'm an open source advocate, but my site is really more focused on self-hosted. And I know there are some great self-hosted projects that aren't open source. So I try not to necessarily discriminate against those that aren't open source. But when I saw you pop up in the show notes, I was like, oh no, did I add two applications that I shouldn't have just blindly not having done enough research? So it's comforting to know they are still self-hostable, but questionable licenses and how they're presenting their code. So if that is a concern to you before anyone would install those, we just recommend you check those out ahead of time and make sure you're comfortable with what they're actually doing versus maybe how they're presenting it. And it doesn't sound like they're trying to be nefarious with it or anything. So
No, I think they just maybe either misunderstood their licensing in the case of maybe Windmill and or just not updated relevant things or thought about the organization in the case of Novu. And I think, yeah, as you say, I think it's fine for applications to not be open source if they can't manage the freedoms and the difficulties that entails. That's absolutely fine. It's just about being transparent to your user base in terms of the terms of what you're providing the application and the code under.
Right. Got it. Want to make just a quick call out. I added a new section to the newsletter this week based on actually something that popped up last week. A bunch of people had reached out with surveys and feedback they were looking for, asked me to add them to the newsletter, and I had included it in the introduction last week. But more popped up this week, and I thought, hey, maybe it's worth having a dedicated section for. So I do have two surveys or projects that are looking for feedback of some sort. So Mealy popped up last week. They're still looking for some users to respond and give some feedback on how they're using the software. And then Multiscrabbler is actually a software I featured in my content spotlight section just a few weeks ago. They're also looking for feedback. They have an integration with Tautuli for, I think, scrabbling Plex listens and statistics. And recently they introduced just native integration with Plex to track that. And so they're just trying to figure out, hey, is everyone okay if we drop Tautuli because now we're supporting Plex natively and we might not need that. So if you're using it and don't want them to deprecate it, please reach out to them. I've included the link to where they're asking for feedback in the newsletter. And with that being said, we have arrived, Dan, at the last section we're going to review today, the community content. I found a lot of good articles. Sometimes I only include one or two. I actually have five, which I think is on the heavier side of what I normally include here. There's a lot of great content being published this week. Of course, the last one, not going to spend a whole lot of time on, but Wallabag, another omnivore alternative. Someone posted this. A guide and just introduction to the platform. Again, for anyone who's using Omnivore and with their acquisition or maybe looking to move away from that. But I want to spend, I think, most of the time on this first post here. And Dan, I know you're going to have a lot of thoughts on this. John O'Nolan is actually the CEO and founder of Ghost, which is a content management platform. It's actually what I use to host my website and send out the newsletter. And so he posted this really interesting article on open source governance. And I think it's an indirect response to all of the WordPress stuff happening. And definitely. So I'm just going to stop talking and let you speak to it a little bit. I know you have your own thoughts about it that I'm super interested to hear.
Yeah, as you said, it is in the direct commentary. And it even uses the same post title as a very popular post by Matt Mullenweg of WordPress. But it's very, very good commentary. I'd recommend any open source maintainers especially to read through this because it gives a very good kind of template, I guess, for how to set up a project and everything around that and the community and all the legal requirements, how to set that up in a way that's really focused on open source and a way that's, as the post title says, democratized rather than being fixed. Because one thing that we're seeing with the current WordPress situation is the implications of what occurs when something as popular as WordPress is owned by a single person. You know, a single person has control over all the plugins, over the distribution of updates, over the main website, and we're seeing how that's being leveraged to do some very much non-open things, really. So, yeah, this is a great way in terms of a great overview of over how John set things up so they aren't directly linked to him or the developers and how it remains with the community. So yeah, I saw a lot of these things are some of these that I have done with Bookstack, or some of the ideas, like in terms of welcoming other hosting SaaS services to use my software, rather than trying to be defensive and, you know, run my own hosting company for my own software and that being my main income. You know, try and democratize that, because that's in the end better for users. And that's going to happen anyway with open source software. Once it gets popular enough, you kind of have to accept that,
right,
rather than throwing ultimatums and suing across or weaponizing your trademarks and things like that. And then, yes, yeah, so, then the rest of this, because this is obviously a project like Ghost is quite a lot more mature in terms of going after growth and audience and things like that. And having an ecosystem than something like Bookstack, it sets a kind of, yeah, a good roadmap of how I could set things up if I were to grow something like Bookstack. And I think it can do the same for a lot of other open source authors out there too.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I would definitely encourage everyone to come in and give the entire article a read. Super interesting. I love following just John in general. I think his content is great, and has a lot of great perspective on things. With that being said, I think we're going to wrap things up. There is more content in the newsletter, so I'd encourage everyone who's listening to this to give it a watch. A lot of good videos popping up this week. Again, actually a lot more than I usually include in here. But please check it out. Give it a listen. Dan, thanks a lot for joining me. Super appreciative of you as always. Not only joining me today, but all the commentary you provide me outside of the newsletter and recordings like this on commentary. I love your projects. Can you just talk a little bit about where your maybe users can find you if they want to connect with you or just browse your content outside of this?
Yeah, sure. So you can find most of my things on my website, which is danb.me, where I always have a blog that talks about random things, including gardening, as well as a lot of open source details and licensing details and things like that. Otherwise, I'm also on Fosterdon, and yeah, you can find links to that on my website, danb.me.
Gardening, open source, and cat photos, right?
That's it. Yeah, that sums me up as a whole.
It's always like a nice reprieve of like the sea of news and articles I read when I see stuff like that pop up. It's like, oh, that's just breaking things up a little bit.
Yeah, but it's quite funny. I could spend like a week on a blog post detailing technical information about like licensing. I put that up there. I guess, you know, a few shares, like maybe five. But then I'll put a picture of my cat up, just a quick like 5 second post. And then it gets like hundreds of shares and whatnot. It's just like, ugh, what's the point? But yeah, I like the cat photo too.
Maybe like you need a new logo for Bookstack that's a cat of some sort, maybe, to drive more
cat stack
interactions and cat stack. Oh, that's hilarious. Well, cool. Again, my name's Ethan. If you want to connect with me, I have a homepage with a bunch of links at ethanshally.com. I will, of course, everything we talked about today is linked in the newsletter. I will link the newsletter in the description below. And then I will also link to all of Dan's content and everything we chatted about that's not in the newsletter in the description below. But again, Dan, thanks for joining me, and thanks everyone for listening. Happy self-hosting.
Goodbye. Have a good week.